this is Paul Green, WGN political analyst and chairman of the City Club of Chicago. Today at the City Club, we had Congresswoman Tammy Duckworth, 8th Congressional District, who spoke about her campaign and what's going on in what the issue she's facing. She started off by attacking Mark Kirk for his comments about President Obama. Kirk called him the drug dealer in chief, and Ms. Duckworth said that that is out of line and he's an unhinged critic. But the guts of her speech was dealing with proposals to jumpstart the Illinois economy. She went through a whole list of things, the typical stuff about clean energy and et cetera. But she also talked about steel mills in far southern Illinois, Granite City, and ended her with that things have to be done to help those kinds of workers, including coal workers in southern Illinois. And she ended her her talk with an emotional conclusion because a question was asked about the value of public education, and Congresswoman Duckworth said without public education she would not be here today, that she was came out of poverty, food stamps, etc., and that got a standing ovation. All in all, it was an excellent speech, and we hope to have Senator Kirk in the near future to respond.
Dr. Green has the, I don't know whether this is good or bad, but he says that the debate he moderated with me in 2012 with Joe Walsh was the only one where he actually required, as the moderator, police protection for his safety, mainly because the venue where we were holding the debate decided to have a bar and open the bar an hour before the debate began for a debate that involved both Tea Partiers and Teamsters. So, and they served alcohol in bottles, which was very interesting. But it's great to be here. This is the second time I've been to City Club of Chicago while I've been a candidate for the Senate. And that baby girl, Abigail, I told you about the last time I was here when I was just off of maternity leave, is now 21 months old. I know, right? She's running me in circles. I don't know where she gets the energy. I'd like to bottle that and take some of it every morning. But I have a feeling she's going to be keeping it up for years to come. You know, one thing I do love is that she already knows a woman can grow up to fly helicopters in combat. And my husband and I had a contest going on as to what her first word would be. And I said, well, I'm going to make sure it's helicopter because every time I breastfeed her, I'm just going to say, have some helicopter, honey. Helicopter. Helicopter. She says copter now. So I won that contest. Look, now she'll grow up, I predict, and by the time she's 8 years old, and well, she'll be 10 because she's going to be 2 by this November, and the only president she will have ever known will be a woman. That's quite amazing. I'm here to talk to you about my vision for getting Illinois' economy back on track again. I think it's especially important for working families across this great state. Before we begin, though, I do want to address something that's happening in the news recently. You know, this is Chicago. We invented the phrase that politics ain't beanbag. And we used a tough language and tough tactics, but what my opponent said the other day about President Obama, however, that he's acting like the drug dealer in chief, is beyond the pale. Look, you can agree with the president or any president and say so. That's the beauty of this democracy. And I've not been shy, for example, to voice my concern with the way this administration went about arming Syrian rebels, by the shortcomings of the TPP. But you can disagree with the president without resorting to the kind of inflammatory rhetoric, which is not only offensive, it's totally unhelpful to the cause of a more stable and secure world. I can't, for the life of me, understand what Senator Kirk thought he was accomplishing. And if it was just the first time, I would chalk it up to a momentary lapse of judgment. But with him, it's a pattern, both of irresponsible, offensive rhetoric, as well as of personal insults directed at this president. The Sun-Times made note of that very pattern this morning, if you read in the editorial. And I'm going to quote from the Sun-Times. This, unfortunately, is not a new problem for Kirk. He has had a way in recent years of choosing his words strangely. In April of last year, the senator told reporters that he favored support of African-American businesses so that black community is not the one we drive faster through. 1 month later, while discussing an impending pact to limit the development of nuclear weapons by Iran, he said that President Obama just wanted to get nukes to Iran. He soon apologized for that, but then he also called the deal the greatest appeasement since British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain gave Czechoslovakia to Hitler. Look, Barack Obama, and Michelle Obama and their two beautiful girls are a credit to this city and this state. You don't have to agree with everything the administration says or does to be able to admire the man and his family, not to mention the dignity that he has shown in the face of relentless attacks from his political opponents. Senator Kirk has just joined the rogues gallery for the president's fiercest and most unhinged critics. And for that, he should be ashamed. What he said is beneath the dignity of the office he now holds, and Senator Kirk should apologize immediately to the President of the United States as well as to the people of Illinois. We're better than that. We were just chatting at the table about what are the best parts of running for office. And for me, the best part of running for office is actually what I'm going to be doing again tomorrow. I just finished doing it about 48 hours ago. It's getting back on the road. I'm going down to Des Moines. I'm going to work our way all the way down the state. We'll be in through Danville and everything, all the way down to Des Moines for the second state fair. Most people don't know that there are two state fairs in Illinois. There's one in Des Moines. So in about 36 hours, I will be eating pork chops on a stick, fried butter. We usually run a contest as to the most disgusting thing you want Tammy Duckworth to eat. And it's pretty bad. Yeah. But look, I've traveled this whole state over and over, and it's been great. It's been a homecoming because I've served over this state in the National Guard. And I visited Granite City a couple of times in the last 18 months. And, you know, this is a steel town in Metro East. And people don't think of Illinois often as part of the Rust Belt, but we have portions of the state that are. And to say that this town is dependent on the local steel mill doesn't even begin to tell the story. Those mills, of course, are dependent on a steel dust industry that is global in scale. One of the first times that I was in Granite City recently, the plant had announced layoffs the week before Thanksgiving, and 2 days after Christmas, this past Christmas, started laying people off. These men and women have done exactly what you're supposed to do. They worked hard, grueling physical labor, sometimes for decades. They produced quality steel and took pride in it. But here they were, out of a job and uncertain what the future holds because factors outside of their control, specifically policies that allowed inferior products, inferior steel made in places like China and Korea to be dumped on the worldwide market at lower cost than it, to be sold at a lower cost than it actually the producers in those countries can make it at. It puts our steel manufacturers at a disadvantage. How do you tell someone who went to work every single day, did their job, put in an honest day's work, and asked only for an honest day's pay in return, that that's no longer enough? This election season has brought so much discussion of trade policy. TPA, TPP, even NAFTA seems to be up for reevaluation. And Senator Kirk and I have some fundamental disagreements, and it's a healthy debate to have. But my trip to Granite City and to communities like it that are struggling all across this great state drives home that this isn't an abstraction. This isn't an academic matter. It's people's lives. It is communities' lives. When the steel mill closes because the parent company is getting crushed on a global market, those steel workers still have to pay mortgage. They still have dreams of sending their kids to college, or perhaps they've already taken on one or two or three student loans to keep the one that's already there. They still have a decade or two or even three of their lives to live and years to go before retirement. We have to do better by them, and we will do better by them. Today, and for the remainder of this campaign, I will be highlighting a series of policy proposals that are designed to help jumpstart Illinois' economy and create jobs by taking advantage of the tremendous resources we have here at our disposal, nature, capital, and human, as well as being smart about making the right kinds of investments in our future and in our people. So let's start with trade. Too often when trade is discussed, it is a reductive confrontation between free trade and protectionism, as though there's no middle ground. I would suggest that there is a fair trade middle ground, and that is what I will be a fierce advocate for in the United States Senate. Make no mistake, our country and our state lose by turning our back on the world. Illinois needs trade to thrive. But when we are debating trade deals, we need to take American manufacturing and American workers into account. Take PP, for example. After a lot of study, reading the entire document, I concluded that I could not support the president's agreement as drafted. In particular, I don't believe the agreement puts in place tough and enforceable rules needed to crack down on countries that manipulate their currencies. And I asked for four different personal briefings at the top secret level by members of the trade team as to what that would be. One of the things that is rolling the American steel industry is unfair trade practices. It also failed to include stricter rules of origin so that partners can't cheat by slapping a Made in Vietnam label on products that are largely manufactured in China but then assembled in Vietnam. You know, this defeats the purpose of the labor and environmental standards we negotiated for in these agreements in the first place. Rather than having more stringent rules of origin, unfortunately, the TPP has lower content requirements than NAFTA does for some industries. And I was very clear about wanting to make sure also that the language on currency manipulation should be, you shall not engage in currency manipulation. Instead, it's more advisory, you should not. My congressional district has the highest concentration of tool and die manufacturers in the nation. These firms employ thousands of people, but they're not multinational corporations that can ride out a downturn simply by shifting production overseas or to some other business, and they stand to lose the most from an unfair trade practice. We're not looking out for them and the good they do for Illinois if we don't do our jobs when it comes to trade agreements. Conversely, I strongly support the administration's efforts to open trade with Cuba. I support the bipartisan Cuba Agriculture Export Act. I think it will actually remove restrictions on export financing and marketing for American agriculture products. This will allow farmers to compete on a level playing field and gain access to a market that is valued right now at over $1 billion per year. Illinois agriculture benefits when new markets open up, especially largely untapped ones that is so close to our own shores. I was also and continue to be a strong supporter of the Export-Import Bank reauthorization. I prioritize being a facilitator for the small and medium-sized businesses in my district to learn about federal resources and held many workshops in my district, teaching them how to apply for Export-Import Bank loans and assistance guarantees. I intend to do so all across this great state as senator. I want to see a manufacturing renaissance here in Illinois, and that starts with investing in our workforce and in our manufacturing businesses. When I talk to manufacturers in my district and now all across the state, the most common refrain that I hear is about the lack of qualified workers to fill jobs for which they're hiring and for the high average age of workers that are already in these businesses. In fact, a 2015 survey by Deloitte and the Manufacturing Institute found that 82% of manufacturing executives say that workforce shortages have a significant impact on their ability to meet customer demand, and that 6 of every 10 production openings they have are unfilled due to a shortage of skilled workers. These are well-paying jobs in modern manufacturing facilities that are fueling our economy. So to address this issue, I introduced a Career and Technical Education Opportunity Act, which is a bipartisan proposal that would allow students enroll in career technical programs to use their federal student aid towards earning industry-recognized credentials, as well as the Community College to Career Fund Act, which is modeled after the Harper Community College's own advanced manufacturing program. In 2014, Harper teamed up with Northrop Grumman in my congressional district to train workers for openings in their high-tech manufacturing facility in Rolling Meadows. Northrop officials were involved in developing coursework specific to their needs. Part of the program include paid internships so that the students could get out of the classroom and develop practical real-world skills. Northrop got to see the students as their interns to see their actual work production. And they ended up hiring 4 students for full-time positions and requested another 7 students for the following academic year. So far, the Harper College program has enrolled over 2,100 students to date for many different manufacturers, and I've introduced a bill to expand this type of program nationwide. It's also a recognition that not everyone can or wants to go to a 4-year institution. And that 4-year degree should not be the only path to middle-class income and stability. Likewise, I also introduced, as one of my first pieces of legislation in Congress, the Troop Talent Act, which makes it easier for our military men and women to transfer the skills they learned in the armed forces into civilian life and receive the proper licensing and credentialing before they leave the military so they can step right into a similar job following their service. There is no uniformity across the branches on this. And I'm co-sponsoring the Manufacturing Reinvestment Accounts Act, which acts like IRAs for your retirement, but for manufacturers, but not for their retirements. These accounts would enable small and medium manufacturers to make annual pre-tax contributions for up to $500,000 into an MRA for a period of 7 years. Funds withdrawn from the account could be invested in machinery, facilities, and job training, thus lowering their tax liability and encouraging them to invest in their workers and in their factories. Helping individuals to reach their potential to create the best workforce in America is a smart investment. So it's ensuring that small and medium-sized businesses, which form the backbone of our economy, have the same advantages as multinationals. To that end, I support reforming and simplifying the tax code to make it more fair and less complicated. I also want to make sure that research and development tax credits for small businesses are protected. Last year, I worked successfully across party lines to insert 4 amendments into the National Defense Authorization Act that will help make it easier for small businesses to compete for government contracts. These proposals will, 1, provide greater accountability for senior agency executives who are responsible for overseeing small business subcontracting. 2, remove barriers to capital for small businesses. 3, improve training for small businesses advocates. And 4, allow more small businesses to compete for federal construction contracts. Rebuilding Illinois' manufacturing muscle requires continuing to invest in areas where we already have an advantage, as well as tapping into some new ones. In the 19th and 20th centuries, we built the great machines that farmed the land all across this great nation. We manufactured the equipment that worked the construction sites and the steel that is the spine of our buildings and our roads and bridges. For the 21st century, Illinois should be a leader in the renewable energy revolution at each step of the process. We're already a leader in installed wind capacity, although there's room for expansion. As it stands right now, only 5% of Illinois' energy needs are coming from wind. Compare that to Iowa, that gets 30% of its energy needs from wind. You know, we should also tap into our advanced manufacturing capacity as well as our central location to build the wind turbines and the components right here in Illinois. In 2011, when I first ran for Congress, I got to tour and visit Bly Industries, which is a small manufacturing facility that used to make components for helicopter parts. They switched to windmill parts, and now they have more orders than they can possibly meet and fulfill for windmill parts with the workforce that they currently have. That's the kind of growth I want to see right here in Illinois. The Chicago area is home to headquarters or regional offices for 14 wind energy companies. After the production tax credit had expired, I organized a letter to former Speaker Boehner from the Illinois delegation, bipartisan letter, encouraging the PTC to be extended as soon as possible. And I was proud that that extension was included in the 2015 omnibus spending bill and signed into law. Here in the Prairie State, we've grown the hogs and farmed the corn and soybeans that fed a nation and the world. In this new era, let's once again put our rich and fertile farmland to use developing the biofuels that will help end our reliance on foreign sources of oil. So I support the renewable fuel standard, which is driving job creation and innovation right here at home and supports more than 852,000 green, well-paying jobs nationwide. These are jobs that can't be shipped overseas. And as you might imagine, this is an issue that's deeply personal to me. It starts with the fact that the first job I ever had in Illinois was working on a project for the American Farmland Trust out in DeKalb, helping farmers convert to no-till farming practices. But it also is based on the fact that if ending our reliance on foreign oil means one less Middle East war, then that is a worthy investment. There is so much promise in renewables, and we have everything in Illinois to be a global leader. Much like Granite City, however, There are places throughout this state that are reliant on a single industry. Only this industry is coal. Let's be clear-eyed about this. The reality of our global energy supply is that coal will remain a major source of energy for much of the world, especially the developing world, for decades to come. If we're serious about addressing climate change, investing in carbon mitigation technologies is smart policy. It will also provide new opportunities for coal workers in Illinois, those who have worked hard and are terrified of an uncertain future. That's why I'm a proponent of investing in carbon capture technology to help bridge old and new energy industries. And I am co-sponsoring a bill to expand tax credits for carbon capture and storage. We can help this generation of coal miners finish their careers with dignity, while also working to make sure their children and grandchildren's futures are in renewables. There are other sectors in Illinois that has great untapped potential, and I plan to bring my experience and expertise on military procurement to bear. Alongside Senator Durbin, who is the ranking member of the Senate Defense Appropriations Committee, I think two strong and effective and committed senators can help leverage Illinois' resources so that the military, as the military continues to modernize and new projects come online, we are in the mix. This also is personal to me. Our troops should be getting the best equipment, period. And if that equipment is made in America, all the better. And if it's made in Illinois, that would be the best. In fact, I have worked hard with a manufacturer called Oshkosh that is out of Wisconsin, and I had talked with them about the fact that when I was running for Congress in my congressional district, I said, I think I have 8 sub and sub-subcontractors for you in my district that produce parts for your vehicles. And the CEO said, no, I don't think so, but I'll check. That sounds optimistic. He came back to me 2 weeks later and said, actually, it's 22. So while we may not have a major defense manufacturer all stand alone in Illinois, we have many who are involved in defense manufacturing. Northrop Grumman just got a major contract. Oshkosh Trucks just got a major contract. There's no reason why we should not be manufacturing so many of the parts that allow our men and women in uniform to be effective and keep them safe right here in our state. In fact, I've been working for the past year with Rep. Cherry Bustos to increase production at the Rock Island Arsenal, which employs 66,000 people in Quad Cities. There are critical defense items being manufactured overseas, which not only might deprive Americans of jobs, but also opens up a number of national security concerns. If it's practical to make those defense items in America at places like Rock Island, we should do that. And as the only Illinois representative on the Armed Services Committee, Demo Republican, I was able to shepherd an amendment requiring just that through the NDAA. Finally, I believe it's time to make a serious investment in our infrastructure. For one thing, we need it. I'm not sure if I'm the only one who got here today on a road or over a bridge or could stand to be in better shape. Don't tell me your stories. I know you've gone over them. In fact, there are over, I think the statistic that I heard a couple years ago was that there are over 200 bridges alone in the Chicagoland area that are deemed to be substandard but safe for travel. I'm not sure how it can be substandard and safe for travel, but we need to repair those. Interest rates are continue to be at a near all-time low, and the economy, while improving, is not growing as fast as we would like it to. The threat of what former Treasury Secretary and economist Lawrence Summers calls secular stagnation is a real one. Making major nationwide investments in our infrastructure makes sense now. I've seen how effective this can be in my own district. I helped secure $300 million in federal funding to begin construction of the long-delayed Elgin O'Hare Expressway extension, which supports 64,000 jobs. That roadway has always been the bane of those of us who live out in the far western suburbs because it neither begins in Elgin nor does it end in O'Hare, but we call it the Elgin O'Hare Expressway. We're fixing that. But it's brought in 64,000 jobs. My office also helped secure a Tiger grant to rebuild a 134-year bridge over the Fox River that had not had a significant upgrade in over 80 years. It will mitigate metro delays for the 50-plus commuter trains that use it every single day. There's a need for projects like this all over Illinois, and they create good jobs. That's why I support the creation of a national infrastructure bank And I support a $478 billion long-term transportation bill that would create 2 million jobs, paid for in part by restricting corporate tax inversions, that is, multinational corporations avoiding U.S. taxes by setting up their headquarters in a P.O. box in a foreign country. On that note, one of the major infrastructure projects we should commit to right now is a nationwide effort to replace lead pipes that carry our drinking water and harm our kids. Whether it's Flint or dozens of public schools here in Chicago, we have a moral obligation to make sure our children's drinking water is clean and safe. Illinois has so much potential. We are blessed to live here. That doesn't mean that there aren't very real challenges or that we're doing as well as we can be doing. We need real leadership to help catalyze our tremendous resources into results that improve the lives and well-being of all our people. So that's what's on my mind when I met with those workers in Granite City, and it's the same thing when I'm in Danville or Rockford or the south side of Chicago. I'm hearing from people who feel like they're working as hard as they can, but they're falling behind. They're worried about sending their kids to college or having a secure and dignified retirement. They've heard that there's an economic recovery, but they're not feeling it. They're looking for solutions. That's the challenge and the directive I take from them. I respect their trouble, their struggle, and I want to honor it by helping Illinois reclaim its rightful place as one of the country's economic and innovative leaders. What, on the other hand, is the incumbent Mark Kirk offering after 16 years in office? Well, you've already seen it in your mailboxes. His pitch to voters is that he's a social moderate, a fiscal conservative, and a national security hawk. So let's unpack that one at a time, shall we? It's true that he has long cultivated a reputation as a social moderate, and he's certainly, say, not from Ted Cruz's wing of the Republican Party, but it's hard to square his self-identification with the action he just took last month when he was tasked with writing the conference report in Congress on the Zika funding bill, and he instead approved the insertion of a poison pill provision that blocked Planned Parenthood from receiving funds for vital public health efforts, such as providing family planning services to help prevent the spread of this sexually transmitted virus. Puerto Rico is already in full crisis over Zika, and there are news stories every day about Zika reaching deeper into the mainland United States. Kirk's Republican Senate colleagues rallied behind the partisan conference report that he co-authored and signed final approval on. We still don't have adequate funding to fight Zika, and more Americans are at risk. Now, we can't even square his statements that the Paycheck Fairness Act is, in his own words, and I quote, the most sexist piece of legislation you can have. You know, I can't think of another way to get Illinois' economy growing. Well, one way that we can get Illinois' economy growing is to actually make sure that women are being paid equal to men and that women are not making $12,000 less than men on average. That's $12,000 less than their families have to spend on the local economy. I happen to think that equal pay is not a sexist thing. When it comes to social moderation, it seems like Mark Kirk is only there when you don't really need him, especially in an election year. But when you do need him, he's either a no-show or he's ineffective. How does he stack up as a fiscal and conservative? Well, it depends on who's in office. When he was sworn in along with George Bush in 2001, the country was actually running surpluses and the national debt was being paid down. This was undone quickly by the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy, by the Medicare prescription drug benefit, and by two wars put on the credit card. Kirk was there every step of the way and voted for it all. He even was a co-author of the Iraq invasion resolution. People forget that. But the Bush administration tapped Mark Kirk, the self-described defense expert, to co-write the Iraq invasion resolution. Dick Cheney summed that era up best. Deficits don't matter. They only mattered to Kirk when Democrat Barack Obama took office and the big spender became an austere deficit hawk. He's not a fiscal conservative. He's a fiscal phony. He is, however, guilty as charged when it comes to being a national security hawk. And my only question here is why he thinks that's something to be proud of. Throughout his career, he's been quick to sound the drums of war. Throughout his career, Kirk has been tragically wrong. I've been to war, and I like to think that I'm pretty tough. I also have a master's degree in international relations, and I'm pretty clear-eyed about the world we live in. I've never felt compelled to call for the military option before exhausting diplomatic ones. And I am genuinely troubled by someone like Mark Kirk, who is so quick to do so and who takes pride in being called a hawk. Let me be clear. My family has defended this great nation for 240 years, going back to the Revolution. My family are among those that bleed first when we go to war. If you need us to go to war, we will be there. My dad served, my husband served, my brother served, I serve. And someday, if I do things right and don't piss her off, Abigail will serve. Families like mine bleed first. War should not be the first option. We should lead with our economic might. We should engage with the world. We should lead with diplomacy. War should be the last option. And I plan on being there in the Senate to make it clear. In the weeks ahead, I'm going to continue to make my case to the people of Illinois, and Senator Kirk will make his. We clearly have different visions on what this state can be and how best to get there. Ultimately, through my own experiences, as well as talking to people all across this great state who want nothing more than to feel that economic opportunity is within reach, I believe that America is at its best when we're investing in our people. I embrace the notion that lifting one another up doesn't cost nearly as much as leaving other Americans behind. And that's why I'm running for the United States Senate. I want to thank you and your time for your time and company today. It's always an honor to address the City Club of Chicago. May God bless you. May God bless our troops who are in harm's way right now. We just lost another brave American in Afghanistan. I just read in the paper this morning. May God bless all of our veterans in military hospitals and VA hospitals all across this great nation. And as always, God bless the United States of America. Thank you. I need water.
Untouched.
This is a crowd to give a long speech to, though.
Yeah, well, we love long speeches.
You are just wicked, aren't you?
Shh, I cannot.
They can hear us.
Okay. We have a question with not that's not signed and not on the official form. So, you know, right, Jackie, we have to stick to the rules. But if we don't have any more questions, I'll have to ask it. Here we go. Patrick Hughes. Please tell us, Patrick, right over there. Please tell us about the camouflage bill you introduced. Fascinating story of millions of dollars saved.
Yeah.
That's called a softball.
That is a softball. So I have, you know, people are going to ask, how do you pay for these things, the policies that I've talked about? And I detailed some of the ways to pay for them, but I've made federal procurement reform one of the hallmarks of the work that I do in Congress. And the camouflage bill is a great example of combining my desire to save money, also my stature as a military veteran. I don't think a lot of other folks could have pushed this bill through. It's a long story. They tell you never sell a story that lasts more than 90 seconds, but bear with me, the payoff is worth it. Up until 2003, the United States military purchased one pattern of camouflage fabric for each environment it operates in, desert, the Arctic, woodlands camel. They use the same fabric, but they cut it into different shapes. And the Marines had pockets that were a little canted. If you remember in Vietnam, it was the green. We called it the pickle suit. In Desert Storm, it was a chocolate chip pattern. We called that the Storm, and Norman Schwarzkopf wore it. But it was the same fabric, and it just said U.S. Army, U.S. Marine, U.S. Air Force on your chest. In 2003, however, the United States Marine, and my daddy was a Marine, God bless Marines, did something that was very typical of the Marines. They invented the first digitally created, computer-generated camouflage pattern. And they embedded into it teeny tiny, like every seventh pixel or something, the letters USMC, the United States Marine Corps, and the symbol of the Marines, the anchor globe and eagle. And they copyrighted it. This led to an immediate arms race between the branches of service to each develop their own camouflage pattern, which so went from 2003 to when I was sworn into office in 2013. We went from one camouflage pattern in each environment to 14, including one that the Navy had that was shades of blue. What does blue camouflage you with? It does camouflage you with a ship, and it's not like we're going to have an aircraft carrier float by in the Persian Gulf and have Al-Qaeda say, oh, there's nobody on that one. We can't see anyone. Let that ship go. The problem, so that the Navy was spending double and a triple the budget of other branches on, in comparison, on uniforms. Because when they were in Afghanistan, they had to buy a whole nother set of camouflage fabric for uniforms for the desert or for the Afghanistan environment. And they couldn't even use the uniform on a ship because when their sailors fell overboard, now they're camouflage. They can't find them in a man overboard situation. It's actually a safety issue. So I introduced a piece of legislation that passed late in the night. It was very controversial because the Marines, there were members of Congress who were Marines who said, you're going to hurt Marine Corps pride. And I had to say, well, I've never met a Marine who was not so proud of his Marines that he would be affected by the fabric that he was wearing. And we passed it, I think, with like two or three votes. We flipped five Republicans, I think. The Government Accounting Office said in the estimates of my proposed bill that it would save $89 million in the first year that if it passed and went into effect. They came back 18 months later and they said it had already saved taxpayers $4.3 billion in a report. There's money that is wasted in government and we can recover it. Medicare knowingly wastes up to $60 billion a year in wasteful and fraudulent claim. It's why I'm partnering with Peter Roskam, a man who beat me in 2006, why I'm co-sponsoring his legislation to go after waste, fraud, and abuse in Medicare. Because I want to take, imagine what we could do in Illinois if we had 1/50th of $60 billion annually. Federal procurement reform. Thanks for the softball.
Congresswoman, can we keep the answers a tad shorter?
Okay. I warned you.
Just a tad.
Okay.
There's the man who asked the question, sure. Okay, real quick, we have Mark Weinmiller, who, of course, is one of our leading radical liberals. Those of you know Mark. I'll answer this question for you, Congresswoman. Uh-huh. I attended the great Walsh-Duckworth debate of 2012. Mm-hmm.
12.
Hey, we work alone here. will Paul Green moderate the 2016 Kirk Duckworth debate? And now many Senate and how many Senate debates? Well, no, I will not moderate. I will not be asked. How many debates are you going to do?
I don't know how many Mark Kirk has agreed to, but I've accepted 5 joint appearances, the Tribune, the Sun-Times, and 3 debates that are televised. I would love it if you would moderate.
Oh, I sure. If I Mark Weinmiller right in front of me. Okay, here we go. Charlie Gardner. Oh, I'm asking a Charlie Gardner question. He happens to be a Roosevelt University trustee. Pure coincidence. It's a good question. A quick answer, Tammy. Are you disappointed with Gabby Gifford's endorsement of your opponent?
I think that is a political decision on their part. I think that I stand on my... If you look at my record on gun violence, it's very clear. I was at the sit-in. I'm co-sponsoring legislation that closed loopholes. Many of organizations have an incumbency endorsement. It's like HRC, right? Mark Kirk had a 30%+ voting record for HRC. In the year he's up for re-election, he gets a 76% voting record, and they endorse him, while I have had a perfect record every year that I've been in Congress. So. This is a political thing, and this is the way it is. Like we say here in Chicago, politics ain't beanbags, folks.
Okay. Edbert Hoffman, member of the City Club, Castlewood Homes. What do you see as the deficiencies in the current version of the TPP, and how would you change them? Okay. Short answer, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, no, I think I touched on it. So the TPP, two main things, country of origin labeling. Actually allows in some categories for products to be made, components in a product to be made in a non-TPP agreement country, shipped, say China, shipped to Vietnam, and actually just basically assembled in Vietnam, and it could actually come into the U.S. as a made-in-Vietnam product, but actually over 50% of the components were made in China, and that I think is unfair. Also, the currency manipulation language I have problems with. It should not be advisory. It should be regulatory. You know, it should be enforceable. So it shouldn't be you should not engage in currency manipulation. My understanding from some of the tool and die folks that I've talked to, the last time we had significant currency manipulation was Japan, and we lost 25% of the U.S. tool and die manufacturing industry. It should be you shall not, not you should not, engage in currency manipulation. So there's two examples right there.
A couple of more. We can't get to all of them. They're time and everything. So this is Seth Earhart. Is that close?
Fine.
Good enough.
That's fine. Good enough.
USMC veteran and a member of the City Club.
Hoorah. Did you have one of the camouflage patterns?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Perfect. First of all, thank you for greatly decreasing the homeless veteran population. My question is, as a senator, what exactly do you plan to do to improve the VA? Take more than 25 words if you like.
The VA requires constant, nonstop vigilance. It is the largest healthcare network in the nation, and even if there is a 1% failure rate for an organization that has 1,000 facilities, you're talking about 10 of the facilities having failure. So it requires constant, nonstop monitoring. I think that the current Secretary of VA being allowed to fire more some of the folks, I think it was a good thing at the very top levels. Veterans are my life's work. I will be working on this for the rest of my life. And I get my health care at VA. I'm so committed to this that even though, like Senator Kirk, we both can get congressionally subsidized health care, I turn my health insurance over to Hines, and I go to Hines for care, and I wait in the same waiting room as my vets, I wait in the same lines, and I go to the same doctors, because I want to see what they go through every single day.
I'm afraid this is the last question, and this is a true City Club question. You're not going to get this. You're not going to get this. Believe me, you're not going to get this in Granite City. Here we go. Tina Padilla. Tina, raise your hand so everyone, there she is. This is a long question. Here we go.
It's very long.
Two of our greatest founding fathers, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, were fierce political adversaries, but these rivals believed in the importance of funding public education. Okay. Our founding fathers knew that public education was the heart of democracy. And she goes on, and she goes on, and she goes on.
It's literally 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, like 20 lines.
But look how neat it is.
Last
sentence is the kicker. I'm getting into it, Tina. Do you agree with our founding fathers? So good. Do you agree with our founding fathers when it comes to the importance of funding of public education? In other words, are you taking on, besides Kirk, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson? Up to you.
Yes, I do. I think that along with our economy, our education system is one of the pillars of our nation's strength. The department, I think our military is also. I wouldn't be here in front of you running for Senate giving this speech if it wasn't for public education. I was a hungry kid. I was on food stamps. And if there wasn't a high school that I could walk to, a public high school in my neighborhood that I could walk to, I would have dropped out of high school. I was, you know, charter schools didn't exist then. I don't know that I would have been lucky enough to win a lottery to get into one. I had a high school English teacher who bought me dinner many nights of the week at the end of the month when the food stamps ran out because 50% of the kids in my high school were on some form of aid. But it was there, and I graduated. And because I graduated, I was able to go to college with Pell Grants and student loans. So I feel so strongly about this that I think that we need to invest in all levels to include, as I've mentioned, I think free community college and free technical schools. I think we need to let students refinance student loan debt. This is something that Mark Kirk and I differ significantly on. He voted against that. He voted against allowing students to refinance student loan debt, and he actually considers free community college to be a handout. I think it's actually a key pillar of national strength. If you looked at America in World War II, one of the reasons why we were able to dominate and win that war was because we had young men who had the basic math, who could step up and become navigators on bombers, who could figure out the artillery calculations for projectiles, the young men who could become fighter pilots and all of these things. And if it wasn't for our public school system that was universal, I don't know where we'd be as a nation. And so I believe strongly that public education, as well as the economy, as well as our manufacturing, might are equally important to our nation's strength as the Department of Defense is.
Round of applause, Tammy.
Thank you.